This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest, Ambassador John Limbert, spent a long career in the Foreign Service and the upper levels of the U.S. State Department. In the early 2000s, he represented the United States in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania, and later served as the first Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, focusing solely on Iranian affairs. He stepped down in 2010, frustrated that more progress wasn't made repairing U.S.-Iranian relations. On November 4, 1979, he was working as a political officer in Tehran when the U.S. Embassy was stormed by students.
The U.S. Embassy in Tehran remains occupied by Iranian students demanding extradition of the Shah and a total break in relations with America. Although as many as 100 people are being held hostage, the State Department says there's no reason to panic.
From what we have gathered, this demonstration is peaceful. And the fact that the demonstrators themselves have described this as a sit-in.
The demonstration wasn't peaceful for long, and the 52 Americans were held for 444 days. In April 1980, President Carter launched an unsuccessful rescue attempt, and in an address to the nation, he appealed to the Iranian captors to continue using restraint.
The mission on which they were embarked was a humanitarian mission. It was not directed against Iran. It was not directed against the people of Iran. It was not undertaken with any feeling of hostility toward Iran or its people.
The failure to bring the hostages home was a key issue in the 1980 U.S. presidential election, and as the Marine Band played during Ronald Reagan's inauguration, the hostages' 14-month ordeal came to an end.
For those of you just joining us, there is confirmation from the major wire services now that the American hostages are indeed aboard Algerian planes that have taken them from Tehran.
Ambassador John Limbert, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you, Suzette. It's nice to be here.
Take us back to that day, 33 years ago, when you were released and this incredible ordeal that you experienced. What was that like on that day?
Okay, we're talking about January 20th, 1981. It was the last day of President Jimmy Carter's administration. It was the day on which Ronald Reagan was sworn into office. We had been held since November 4th, 1979, so 14 months. When the original attack came, our priority was keeping everybody safe with the assumption that within a matter of hours or at most one day, those in authority would step in and exercise adult supervision over the situation and resolve it. Now, we might end up have stayed in Iran as diplomats. We might have left Iran under those circumstances. But what I think very few people foresaw was that this thing would change from a 1970-style student sit-in to a full-blown international crisis that would end up costing Jimmy Carter his presidency and casting a shadow over U.S.-Iran relations for the next 34 years.
So this experience that you had, I can't imagine. How did you and your colleagues endure? I mean, what did you do? Did you know what was going on in the outside world? Did you know about the rescue attempt?
We had no contact with the outside world. We had no news. We had no access to radio. We had no access to newspapers. Our mail was very limited, strictly controlled. We had very limited communication with each other. We would try to spread news. But for whatever reason, the policy of those holding us or the actions of those holding us were to keep us isolated from news of the outside. I felt perhaps they felt we would be more malleable or more manipulatable because of that.
Okay, so the day comes and you're ready to go. I mean, did this come as a huge shock the day that you were released? Had you lost hope about being released?
No, we never lost hope. There had been some false signs before that things might change. So you didn't deliberately get your hopes up too high because you knew that something could go wrong, there could be a problem. But there were two major indications that something major was going on. One was the visit approximately a month before we were released by an Algerian mediation team. There was an official from the Algerian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and then the Algerian ambassador in Tehran who came around, visited us, and told us in general terms what was going on, not specifics, not who was saying what or who was bargaining what. But this was certainly a very positive sign. It was the most positive sign that we had seen in a long time because these were serious people. And the fact that they had visited us, the students who were holding us either allowed them to do it or were forced to allow them to do it and had no choice. And so the sign was something serious is in the works and there looks like a change going on. Put that together with the change of administration in the United States and there was reason for hope.
So clearly since that time and your release, I mean, you've gone on to have a significant career in the Foreign Service and particularly throughout other parts of the region in the Middle East. How was that for you to return back to the region? And have you ever made it back to Iran?
I've never been back to Iran since that. This is not my choice. I would like to go back. I would like to take our children back because they were both born there. Would like to take our grandchildren back there because it's part of them. But so far, I'm not welcome.
And that's meaning not welcome
by the Iranians.
You would not be welcome there because of them.
That's right. Yeah. American tourists go. American visitors go.
So there's no prohibition for you to go from our perspective.
No,
from the US
there's
government.
There's no thing. I'm a private citizen. I don't work for the State Department anymore. So there's no prohibition on it. Why this is so, I don't know. I think I remind them of a chapter in their past they would probably like to bury. And I wouldn't let them do that if I were there. I would be a walking reminder forcing them to confront something that they would prefer not to. In terms of my career, I went back to working in the Foreign Service. Because it's what I do. It's what I know. And the experience reinforced the idea that this is important, that diplomacy is important, that talking among states is important because during those 14 months, we had all witnessed firsthand the alternative, that when communication breaks down, the alternative, frankly, is anarchy, violence, and lawlessness. Now, the international arena, the stage for international relations is already a pretty chaotic place in the best of circumstances. But when you remove every vestige of order and rule, then what are you left with? You're left with a kind of very, I call it Hobbesian universe. In which only the strong survive, and there is nothing to protect anyone else. It's ironic, really, that during all this, the Iranians kept saying that they didn't care about international law, they didn't care about international organizations, international structures, but those structures are there to protect the smaller countries. Presumably, the superpowers, the large powers, don't need them quite as much. It's countries like Iran that, in fact, need that kind of protection.
So it only hurts them to not participate in international organizations and abide by international law.
Well, the whole incident was for Iran and Iranians was incredibly self-destructive. I mean, you start to catalog, but just one example was the Iran-Iraq War. Saddam looked at Iran. He saw this country that was isolated, that was in turmoil, that was tearing itself apart. And correctly, he estimated that when he attacked, no one or almost no one in the international community would take Iran's side.
So critical mistake made by Iran.
Well, if they were thinking that way. I mean,
strategic mistake.
That's right. We don't live in a rational world. I wish we did, but we pretend we do sometimes. But we don't. And these were not decisions taken on the basis of a measured consideration of national interest.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about your passion now. I mean, obviously that experience, the passion that you have for diplomacy and open channels of communication and working together in that respect. So let's fast forward to today. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, after this crisis, damaged relations, Iran-U.S. relations, you know, have pretty much been non-existent since that time. But where are we headed today? I mean, as a diplomat, do you see that there's some hope for normalized relations now, particularly in light of a change of regime in Iran? Is the U.S. now more interested in redeveloping those ties? Where do you think we're headed today?
As a diplomat, my profession demands that I always be an optimist, that I always see something better out there. If you're not an optimist, you're probably in the wrong field. You shouldn't be in this field. You should be in something else. The fact of the matter is that for 34 years, the U.S. and Iran barely talked to each other. And if we did talk to each other, it was usually yelling at each other or calling each other names, insulting each other, threatening each other, sometimes worse than that. Where are we headed? Well, clearly something is changing. After the election of Hassan Rouhani in Iran, the Iranians have undertaken a new direction. The election of Barack Obama in 2008 set the United States in a new direction, where President Obama used language and styles toward Iran that had not been heard in a long time. For 5 years, however, there was not a positive response to that. And so what you have now is a coincidence, call it a fortunate coincidence, of two leaders who seem to have some common features in their vision of the relationship. Until now, you haven't had that. You had – if one side seemed interested – in changing the relationship, making some progress, the other side pulled back. It could have been bad luck, bad coincidence, bad timing, whatever it was. When under President Clinton, when the U.S. reached out in 1997, 1998, the Iranians pulled back. In 2003, the Iranians came forward with a plan. The Bush administration wasn't interested. Now, and in 2009, President Obama came forward with his ideas. The Iranians were not very responsive. Now you have a situation where it's possible that the two sides could actually talk, could come together at the same time. Because after all, President Obama 5 years ago spoke about engagement based on mutual interest and mutual respect, something that the Iranians had always said they wanted. 5 years later, President Rouhani is now talking about moderation. Even the Supreme Leader is talking about flexibility. This is new in the political vocabulary. And so you have a coincidence of leadership with certainly not the same vision, but at least similarities in their visions of how this relationship might go.
So potentially not opening the door for a better future laying ahead, I suppose. That's the optimistic view.
Well, what we have is maybe the door isn't open. Maybe the window isn't open, but maybe there's a small crack in this wall of mistrust and suspicion and hostility that's divided us for over three decades.
Well, it certainly will be interesting to see how this develops and how this kind of, you know, coming together and the timing of these two leaders at one time might play out. Well, thank you, Ambassador Lembert, for sharing your story with us today. It's very inspiring, and I appreciate you being here to share this with us.
Well, thank you, Suzette. My pleasure.